I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course I would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course I want to play at the weekend.
Now, we've got a very special interview for you on this afternoon's podcast. It is the great Ewan Murray of Sky Sports, former professional as well. Look at you laughing when I say the great Ewan Murray.
No one's ever introduced me like that.
It's the passable Ewan Murray, everyone. You're welcome, Ewan. So listen, you're talking to a golf mad audience here, and they have spent, like me, many hours watching golf with you. So it's lovely to have you on. I wonder, do you keep track of how many hours broadcasting you've done?
I don't. I just look forward to the next one, basically, and what's gone is gone.
Well, listen, there's so much to talk to you about. We know your work with Sky, obviously. You're also a former professional across the 70s and 80s. You had managed to hit scratch by 13 years of age, I was reading. Mm-hmm. So clearly, golf came naturally to you. And I know your father was a professional maybe 5 miles west of Edinburgh. So you were one of those kids, one of those lucky kids who effectively spent all hours on a golf course and sunset on a golf course and practicing your chipping and your putting and falling in love with this wonderful game.
You've got that 100% right. My father was pro at a club called Babberton, which is on the west side of Edinburgh. And I did, from the age of 4 or 5, I chipped and putted, and when I was allowed out in the practice range, I went out there, and certain hours I was allowed in the golf course, I went out there. It was the most wonderful childhood. I couldn't have asked for more, because I was with my parents all the time, or certainly not too far away from them. They obviously knew where I was, and the long summer days up there in Scotland were spent at Babberton, beginning the game of golf. And a bit later on, East Lothian, not too far away, so some magnificent golf courses down there. I was a junior member of Dunbar, and obviously played at North Berwick and Gullen and Llangrhedrig, Kilspindie, all places like that. So a better childhood, I don't think I could have ever have wished for.
Was your father very hands-on, Ewan, in terms of coaching you?
Yes, he was very much hands-on. He was a good coach. A lot of the top amateurs in Scotland would come to Babberton and have lessons from my father. So he had a very good reputation as a coach. He was also a good coach in the sense he never pressured you to do anything, but he kept his eye on you. And as you were growing up, and obviously your body was changing, you were getting taller and beginning to fill out a bit, he would take all that into account. And when he passed away early, passed away at 62 years of age. And I have to say that when that happened, a little bit of me, I think, probably went with him.
Mm. He's too indelibly linked with your golf game.
Without question, yeah. And the joys, when you look back as you get older into the autumn of your life, the joys of growing up and playing golf with your father. My mother was also a golfer as well. To be able to look back at the time she spent on the golf course, as well as then being parents, proper parents in your house and schooling, etc. I was tremendously fortunate, and I'm well aware of that.
Mm. So scratch at 13, there's obviously natural talent there. Tell us a bit about your game. And I suppose you must have even realized yourself, God, here at 13, 14, 15 and starting to win competitions as a junior, that this game is coming easier to you than most.
That's a very good question, because I don't say it to many people, but golf did come easy to me. I felt playing golf wasn't difficult. It was only when I grew up and became a bit wiser, I realized just how difficult it was. And I had a putting problem from a very young age. I was a great putter, like most kids are. And then one day I had this twitch with my hands where the club collided with the ball, and I couldn't work that out. I couldn't understand that. But I remember where it was, when it was, what day it was, what time it was. And I battled through that, to be honest, as a professional golfer. And sometimes I got over it and I putted reasonably well, and other times it would come back. And I got to the stage that because of the problem I had with the putter, that I was no longer playing to win because I didn't think I could win. It was a weakness. And I finished playing at 35.
What age were you when that twitch first happened?
15. It was May. The course was Longniddrick, which always had the best greens in East Lothian. It was always at Longniddrick, so it wasn't the greens. It was early morning. I was off at 8:20. I had my second shot to about 5 feet, and it happened. And I didn't know what it was. And it went on all day. And I remember I used to keep stats then as a young kid, which was probably unheard of then, because we're talking about back in 1970. And I hit 17 greens in regulation and shot 71, 72, which
painful.
Was probably five shots too much per round. And I must have got rid of it fairly quickly, because I made the final of the British Boys when I was 15, and I was tiny. I was 4'10". And I was putting normally then. So I must have got over it fairly quickly. And then it came back, and I had to devise all sorts of ways to try and get over it, a bit like Bernard Langerstam throughout his career, split hands and eventually the long putter. But it was always a problem. And in 1971, I won the Scottish Boys with my right hand 6 inches from the shaft, from the head, and the left hand at the top. Wow. It was the same story when I won the stroke play 4 months later, and also when I was playing in the World Championship in San Diego. It was the same thing then. But then that passed. But it was always there. In the back of my mind, it was always there. And I felt so stupid. I felt guilty at not being able to find the strength to get over it. Because there's no reason for it. You've been doing it all your life and all of a sudden it happens. So it's something I still think about today. And if I was to go out now with you on the putting green, it would still be there. It's ingrained in me because I never really worked out the formula to defeat it. I remember as a pro, I won at Royal Dornoch, the Northern Open. And I was five shots in front coming up the 18th. So there was no pressure. And I had a couple of drivers on the green to about 5 or 6 feet. So I had a putt to win by six shots. And the putt finished 8 inches short and 4 inches wide. And absolutely no pressure at all. I could have had five putts and still won. But so it wasn't I felt the pressure. It was just something that had happened to me and I needed to find a way out of it. But I hate to admit, I didn't.
Oh, the embarrassment at times.
Without question, embarrassment of putting with your right hand 6 inches above the head of the putter. I mean, that was embarrassing enough, but it was the only way I could actually get the ball in the hole from a foot or 15 inches. From 10 feet and outside, I was probably pretty much like any other golfer. But the nearer I got, And it got to a stage when even when you knocked in a 6-inch putt, it didn't go in the middle of the hole. You didn't really have control over it. And I played with Bernard Langer when he was 18 in Holland, the Dutch Open. And the first 9 holes, he hit 8 greens in regulation and hit the par 5 in 2, and he was out in 44. He actually took a divot at the green from 4 feet at the 9th. And I remember going into the press centre, speaking to some of my pals there, and said, I've just seen a guy who's probably the best golfer I've seen, but you're never going to hear of him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we move on, 46 years, he's had 40 wins as a senior golfer, and he's got a couple of majors and many others tucked away in there. So Bernard had the strength and the courage to get through it, and I'm ashamed to say that I did.
Well, no, I don't. I think shame is a bit much. Do you remember speaking to your father and saying, Dad, I don't know what the hell this is, but it feels like there's an electric eel in my hand and these putts, what do I do? Because I'm sure it was like, oh my God, don't even say the word. Don't even say the word.
My father told me when I was 12 or 13 and knocking in putts from all over the place that I needed to sort my putting stroke out. He said that the putter went outside and the way back and inside and the way through. And he says, if you're not careful, you'll have a problem with that. But as a young kid, I was knocking putts in from all over the course, you know, just like any young kid does, because he doesn't think. He just aims, looks at the line and hits it. So it happened on that morning. And as I say, I managed to get over it two or three times. But in the end, it proved insurmountable.
Wow. So like, if I was to throw a theory at you then, it's that there was maybe something suspect in your technique that you could compensate for with the joys of youth. And then when you were struck by it, that initial moment of horror was almost so deep that it left a scar. And so something was always there, is it? Because it sounds like you tried different techniques afterwards. So there is a certain mystery with this very strange thing in golf from 4 or 5 feet in, you know, to quote Ben Hogan, it should be worth half a shot.
Yeah, and I got a putter from Orville Moody, who won the US Open in the late 60s in Houston. And I was playing with him down in Columbia. And he saw that I wasn't just as good as I should have been on the green. And he said, look, take this putter, because I've got 3 or 4 of them at home. And it's the one that a lot of players use with up the inside of the left forearm. Like Kuchar has been using it. Morikawa's had a go at it recently. And there's one or two others as well. Zalatoris has got it up there. And that got me through 10 years.
Right.
Because whatever anyone says, that putter's anchored. It's anchored into your left forearm. So as long as you just move your left forearm to the right and to the left, then you should be okay. I wouldn't say I was perfect, but I did manage to win the Zambian Open in 80. That was against a strong field in a good course. And I won in Nigeria, which was a big money tournament more than anything else, played on grass and sand. But it got me through these. And then when my father died the following year, I don't know, I'd kind of lost the resolve then to find out why this happened and what I could do about it and could I get over it. So that's the history of it. Not very pleasant, I know, but that's the truth.
You must have been a great ball striker then. The rest of your game must have been very good because, as you mentioned, a pro, 70s and 80s, 1980, as you mentioned there, Zambian Open, £25,000, no less, for that Nigerian win in 84, which I read you bought a house with as well. So you were doing quite nicely considering you had this handicap of sorts. Ball striking then, was that your forte, Ewan?
Well, as I said earlier, I never found golf terribly difficult as a youngster, probably because my father's eyes were always on me. I was never allowed to get into bad habits. I believed everything that he said and asked me to do. And because I started at 3 or 4, it was like picking up your knife and fork. I just didn't find it that difficult. Golf got very difficult, obviously, as you grew up and you began to have an adult mind. But in these days, it was just reaction. It was put the tee in the ground and the club behind the ball and reaction. So, and if you win often enough, which I did a lot as a 14, 15 and 16 year old, then you expected to go out and win. You weren't frightened of winning. You had no fear of failing. So golf was a relatively easy game to me. It was only later I realised how difficult it was.
Yes. And so your swing, for instance, would you have been considered very technical and conventional player? Were you a bit more swashbuckling and put it down and I'll play it how I feel it and I'll shape it how I feel in this moment? What kind of a player were you, tee to green?
Natural. I wouldn't say technical because if you go back to these times, teaching wasn't technical. They didn't have all the gadgets they had today and all the people who have dedicated their life to teaching. The stuff my father told me was all very simple, a bit like the PGA stuff, you know, the grip, the alignment, the stance, the posture. And as long as you had that and you had good hand and eye coordination, you, you were going to be a decent player. I also had a very good short game. I mean, before the putting problems and pitching and bunker play, I had a really good short game. So even on days that you maybe weren't at your best, I was still able to get round. But a natural swing rather than, I don't think I had any major swing thoughts.
So all
really quite simple.
I know you've had some back trouble at times, like so many golfers of a generation. So do you get out and play much now? What's your relationship with the game now when you stand on a first tee?
I haven't played for nearly 2 years because of the back problem. I'm still having treatment on that. And hopefully I will be able to get out. But, you know, as you get older, you're not as supple. I'm a bit lazy. I don't train very much, although I should. There's a lot of senior golfers do a lot of stretching exercises and they maintain that elasticity that you need as you get older. But I'm a member of some great golf clubs and I feel a bit guilty that I haven't made more of an effort to go out there and play. But then I see a lot of golf as well. So my time at home, I'm not sure I desperately want to run out and play golf, but I would like to go out when the feeling takes me.
Yeah. I have memories of you working with Darren Clarke and his game almost as a, I don't know, was it officially as a coach or just as a friendly observer? Did you work with many players on their games as a coach?
Gary Evans was the first one I worked with. Gary lived not very far from where I live now. And he came up to the house one Christmas Eve and just said, I'm in a terrible mess. I haven't got any money. I've got two young kids. And he says, isn't my golf's going nowhere? He also had a serious hand injury. So I said, well, we'll go out and hit some balls and see how we go from there. And it was difficult to start with because of the injury to his hand. He had a four-knuckle left-hand grip. So I turned him into a fader of the golf ball to take away the fear of hooking. And he had four really good years. He won about €400,000 or €500,000, got himself back in a position that he wanted to be in. And he ended up being one of the easiest guys to coach because he's very much a natural player. Darren was the same. It was at Carton House I first started coaching Darren. Just walking down the range and he asked me a couple of questions and I gave him what I thought was honest answers. And he should have won that week. He actually made a mess of the last three holes at Carton House, and I think he finished third. But it was a very difficult time in Darren's life, 2006, because Heather, at the age of 38, was failing fast, and it became more of a strong friendship. But I spent many hours with him at tournaments and also at Queenwood, where he's a member to the west of London. And we'd go up and spend 6-7 hours hitting balls there. But I felt that I could give him time, which I think he needed. He needed someone alongside him with all the things that were going on. He had two young kids. Conor and Tyrone were 8 and 6 years of age. And it grew from there. And I was with him all the way through to the end of the year he won the Open. He also talked to other coaches, which I encouraged, because I don't think one coach should think he has all the answers. And he would spend quite a bit of time with Pete Cowan, who he'd worked with before I'd met him. But I think it was more the friendship and the time we spent together. That was all I could give Darren, was time. I couldn't be his full-time coach because I had another job. But I used to see him at tournaments and at Queenwood and we'd play a few holes together as well, which I really enjoyed. And he was like a younger brother that I didn't have. And I was maybe like an older brother that he didn't have. I don't know. But we got him through a very difficult time. The Ryder Cup of 2006 was traumatic because he only had 2 or 3 weeks. Ian Woosnam had said, look, I'm happy to give you a wild card. And Darren rang me up and he said, do you think my game's going to be good enough? And I said, I don't have any worry about how good your game's going to be, but I worry about you, you know, after what you've gone through. And it's in Ireland. So that was a very difficult time, but it was joyous in the end because he won 3 points out of 3. And And he started to rebuild his career. He started to want to go out and practice, which he hadn't really done for 2 or 3 months, and probably wouldn't have done had it not been the Ryder Cup. He probably would have just shut down and maybe come back the following year. But with a friend alongside him, I think he felt that was more like a crutch than anything else. Mm. And he was the easiest guy to teach in the world. I mean, if you blindfolded Darren Clarke, he could hit the ball as good as anyone. I mean, he proved that in the first hole of the K Club. You know, when he stepped onto that tee with Westwood, I wondered if this could come off the toe, it could come off the heel and go through his legs, knowing what was in his mind. And we had spoken at 4 o'clock in the morning because he wasn't sleeping properly. And of course, he thumps it 305 yards down the fairway, pops it in the green and knocks in the putt. And that was a joyous moment in a very difficult time. Mm. Our relationship grew, and even up to last week at the seniors, we talked every day there. And he's just a really good pal, a pal I've been very fortunate to have.
Mm. Talent to beat the band as well. Goodness me.
How to?
Talent to beat the band.
Oh, I mean, there's some things Dan could do that the very top players in the world couldn't do right now.
Mm.
And I think that somehow held him back because he became a bit of a perfectionist. You know, Darren could hit 10 forearms down the pin and then one would go 12 feet right and he'd say, what happened there? And I think, well, you're not capable of holding a putt of 12 feet or... And we'd laugh about it, but he was that good.
Mm.
When he was on, he was pretty much unbeatable. And he should have won more, but he was a perfectionist and everything had to be perfect. And you know what this game's like? It's not a game of perfect. It's as simple as that.
No. So when you, and I suspect those 4 years from 85 to 89 were difficult in the extreme if you're dealing with the fallout of your father's death, who you're incredibly close to, and then you're watching your first career and first love almost slip through your fingers a little bit. Were you at the turn of the 90s then worried about the next 40 years of your life and what am I going to do for money and is there everything going to be all right? Like, was this a crisis point or were you fairly blasé about drifting into part two of your life?
Oh, no, I certainly wasn't blasé about it. And these 4 years were difficult. I played in a lot of pro-ams. I started putting left-handed, which was okay.
Right.
The only thing was my dominant eye was my left and not my right. So I didn't know where I was aiming, but the stroke was fine. And I got used to it. I got used to knocking in putts again at 3 or 4 feet. But you had to shoot 67 and 68 to make 200 or 300 quid.
Right.
And I did that for 4 years and I played a little bit in Scotland on the Tartan Tour there and made some money, but not very much. But I knew there was a time when I had to say, right, that's the end of you playing.
Mm.
And what you have to do now is work out what you're going to do. And I always liked journalism. I was friends with some of the best journalists in London through my time at Walton Heath. So John Junior was the editor of Sunday Express for 27 years, and he was like a second father to me. And I got into that circle, and I quite enjoyed journalism. I started to enjoy writing, which I did for a couple of magazines, a monthly magazine. But that was never going to give you a career. So television, I was lucky. It came along at just the right time, satellite television. And I got a break, an unusual break, to get into satellite television in Dubai. That was my first one. And it went from there because Sky Sports then had started. Well, they hadn't. Eurosport was the sports channel of Sky at that time. And then I went to Screen Sport, who had the American Golf and the European Golf. And I did that with LXA. And the money was quite good. I was earning more doing that than I was earning playing golf, that's for sure.
Mm.
And then in 1992, Sky Sports started up. So I was tremendously fortunate, just in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And the rest is history. By the way, listeners, I should point out to you, when he says he got an unusual break, he stole Brian Barnes's gig. But the less said about that, the better. You can look that up yourself. He's been very kind to himself there. An unusual gig. Yes, I'll do it, is when the phone call for Brian came through. Actually, this is the last question on the pudding. It sounds like you tried everything. Did you give the old Jordan Spieth eyes closed, close to the hole routine a try?
Did all that. But if I go out and putt left-handed now, I can actually putt quite well. And I putt as well as anyone with the chest putter.
Right, interesting.
But that's banned, using it on the chest. It's not so easy when you move your hand away because there's a bit of wobble in the top of the club. But with that putter, yes, that's why I think it should be banned, because... Mm. I'm a decent putter with a long putter, and I'm terrible with a normal putter.
Hmm. So we asked the listeners, any questions for you and about Sky and the commentary and these last, 30 years? Wow, time flies. The most common question was, does he enjoy the Guardians, Ewan Murray, taking credit for his commentary work after every tournament? I presume you see one of the great joys every Sunday evening on Twitter after a golf tournament is Ewan Murray either responding to praise or criticism.
Well, we're both two very different people, although there's only one letter that changes our names. He's a great wordsmith. Ewan Murray of The Guardian, you're talking about.
Yeah.
And he thoroughly enjoys answering nice messages that somebody might say, I really enjoyed the last day of the Open Championship, well done and whatever. And he'll reply to that and say, yeah, I thought it was pretty good as well, which I would never do. And then there was one after I put the mic down at the Open this year from Glasgow, who said I was an idiot, Scott. Who doesn't speak in a Scottish accent, because you're ashamed of it. It was horrible. And Ewan thought, don't worry about that. I'll deal with that. And it was something like, you come down to the commentary box, I'll put the kettle on, I'll make you a cup of tea, and I'll stick this microphone right up, ... And then the guy sends it back to me, or he sent one to me and said, you're a disgrace. How's Sky actually? Of course, I've done nothing. But I think Ewan quite enjoys it, and a lot of people get a lot of fun from it. So why change it?
Oh, listen, it's a personal highlight. Personal highlight. So you'd people really take TV commentary and TV coverage seriously. And on the podcast, don't worry, we, as much as we will debate what's wrong with Rory at the moment after big tournaments, we'll have a what did you make of the TV coverage section. And the No Laying Up podcast will do the same in America. People really want good TV and a good broadcast. So you would have a good sense of why sometimes it works and why it doesn't, and the ebb and flow and the rhythm. And does it come down to, I don't know, how many players are in contention when, you know, too many or too few, or you're reliant on the pictures, I'm sure. Sometimes there's a lovely rhythm to a broadcast and it works and everything seems to be flowing. And other times... it just doesn't. It's either too slow, or then someone, you know, shoots up the leaderboard and you haven't seen the first 15 holes they've played, and suddenly they're a big part of the narrative and you're like trying to shoehorn them in a little bit. All of these variables that you can't plan for so much. So give us your sense, because you've so much experience and you know the good days and the bad days, and probably have a better sense of why they're good or why they're bad.
A lot of people say to me that you're lucky doing the Masters and the PGA and the US Open, the Open Championship, the Ryder Cup. I treat every tournament I do the same. I do the same preparation for it. The pictures give you the words. And if the pictures are a bit slower, then the commentary is going to be a little bit slower. I think the word you use, rhythm, is very important. And that depends an awful lot on who's alongside you. I was fortunate, Bruce Critchley alongside me for 20 years, a tremendous command of the English language. And then I have Butch Harmon, probably the world's greatest coach. Butch's time down on the range with his players kept him young. They gave him an extra 10 years in his television career. But Butch was different from Bruce. And I think what you have to realize is what they do. And you have to dictate the rhythm to who they are. If you had Nick Faldo, and we had Nick Faldo in for the Open, Nick is different. He's different from Butch. He's different from Bruce. He's more golf orientated. He's more of what's going on in the player's mind. So you give him enough space to deliver that, because I think that's what people want to hear. They don't really want to hear what I've got to say, because I'm keeping the program going. But if you've got someone like Nick Faldo alongside you, Nick Price was another one. Nick was an outstanding commentator. I did a few things with him in the States and also down in Zimbabwe. Sergio Garcia is probably the best player we've had in, tremendous commentator. And again, I think you have to give them the space they need to deliver what they have and at what pace they deliver it at. So the rhythm often comes from that. Mm. It can also come, as you well know, from your production, the voices in your ears, because they're controlling the speed of the pictures. So if you work closely with them, you probably have the right rhythm to the pictures. But every day is different. I think that's one of the joys of being a broadcaster. There's no 2 days are the same. It's a bit like being a golfer. Mm. You know, the day before you shoot 66 and everything's easy, and the next day you struggle to shoot 74. That's the beauty of broadcasting. Each day is a totally different animal and has to be a totally different start and finish. It's not something you just continue from the day before, because it will be different. The players are different. The scoring's different. The weather's different. The course is different.
If I was to watch commentary of yours across 5-6 hours from 20 years ago, would I notice a difference to what I watch now?
Yes, in the sense that the first 2 years I was on my own, it was just me. That's just the way it was done then. You may have a guest in, you may have had a player in that finished his round and he'd come in for half an hour, but that would be more interview-like. I don't think you would notice a tremendous amount. Golf has changed. It's much more statistical now than it ever was at the start of my television career. The thing I find with statistics is somebody writes them all down, and if every commentator has the same statistics, they're saying the same things. I think the beauty of commentary, if you think back to Richard Benno, if you think back to Dan Maskell, Bill McLaren, Peter Ellis, James Hunt, all the really what I would call classy commentators, they commentated on the picture. They didn't do preparation work. They commentated exactly on what's on your screen. And that, to me, is commentary. Blotting out statistics, I'm not sure everybody wants. They're okay now and again if they match the picture. But I find a lot of commentators now have iPads and computers and phones, and they're logged into statisticians. And out comes the stat when it's not probably the right time to put it in there. I find that's changed a lot, and I'm sure that will be the future. I do have a lot of statistics, but I don't use many of them unless the pictures prompt me to use it.
One thing, so I, and you could really speak of this because you're digesting pictures in real time constantly. So I do the Six Nations coverage on television here in studio. And so the first year I did, I was a bag of nerves. And what struck me watching the coverage afterwards is, you know, when you come back off halftime or full time or at certain moments, they'll show replays with the bits of music and you talk over them and all this kind of stuff, is I was too nervous to take in those pictures and to notice the small little details or the smirk or the high five there. And you'd watch it hours later at home, not nervous, obviously, and think, I didn't even see the fact that those two had done that little funny celebration together. And I was talking over it at the time. And it just struck me, God, the significance of nerves. So for you to do your job well and really, like, in real time, take in anything that could happen, a gesture, a smile, whatever, you need to be just relaxed. You need to be watching as close to as you would be on your couch in terms of relaxed to take everything in, I would think. And to be, you would need to enjoy it, I would think. Nerves, there's no place for nerves in your seat.
I think if you enjoy anything, you've got a good chance of being good at it. I think if you don't enjoy it, it doesn't matter how hard you work. That job is not for you. I was told I had a producer for the first 2 years of my television life who travelled with me to all the tournaments, and we would do the broadcast, me on my own, him in the production room. Then we would meet up for dinner, and he would discuss all these things you're talking about, high fives and all that, that right. you missed.
Yeah.
And he would say, you know, this part of the program you did really well, so keep that, but you need to get rid of this. This isn't good enough if you're going to make this your career. And he had a way of telling me these things without destroying you, you know, without just saying that was rubbish. Mm-hmm. He would just say, you really need to get rid of that, and you need to find another way to do that. Mm. And when you said nerves, a lot of it's adrenaline, and the mouth tends to work quicker than the brain at times as well. And he just said, look, less is more. And I think when you feel more comfortable and you feel you can add to that chap giving it the high fives at your coverage, then add to it. And you'll have the confidence and the experience to do that. But if you're unsure of it at the beginning, don't do it.
Yes.
Because there's nothing wrong with silence. I mean, there's some commentators that are fearful of silence. When, if you've put the right comment in, you can let it hang. And then when the picture changes, you move on. That took a while to learn because you felt as a commentator you needed to talk a lot. In actual fact, silence is probably one of your best weapons, if not the best. So yeah. I wouldn't be too worried about what you missed, but you had the honesty to go back and watch it and think, well, the next time that happens, I'll be different.
Yeah. Oh, and don't worry, my attitude in year one was don't be a hero. So I said very little, very few chances taken. It's easier way in, I think. Don't be noticed is often a good rule of thumb. I guess the other thing is you're freakishly lucky in that you get the Tiger Woods era. You know, I mean, that's just once in a lifetime stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, once maybe in five generations, as good as Tiger was. And, you know, sometimes you see a showreel of some of these great shots, and that showreel could be a day long because there were so many of them. And they all happened at exactly the time he would have wanted them to happen. You know, I go back to the pitch from the back of 16 at Augusta. You know, things are not looking good. He's on the wrong side here. He's struggling to catch up with DeMarco. And he chips in. And it has the swoosh. Just for 2 or 3 seconds, just sitting there and then in. His second shot in Canada, his putt at the TPC of Sawgrass, and all sorts of wonderful things that he did, stinger shots, and round trees. To have lived in Tiger's era, it's just so unbelievably fortunate, because I would still say the greatest champion of all is Jack Nicklaus, with his 18 majors and so many seconds and so many thirds. But maybe the greatest golfer of all time was Tiger. And that's a compliment to both players.
We were down to Padraig Harrington recently, and he had an interesting observation on Woods. When you mentioned the showreel there, it just reminded me of it. He was saying that, you know, Woods ostensibly played a very conservative brand of golf a lot of the time. And then when he needed to, he pulled out the shots. And Harrington's contention was, we would have actually seen, you know, double or treble the length of showreel if Woods had needed to do it.
That's a very good point that I have no arguments at all with. I look back at Hoylake. When Hoylake was all burnt up in 2006, I think he hit one drive. Might have been two, but I think it was one. And he just plodded his way around there. He looked at the golf course and thought, a 4 iron's enough off the tee. It's going to run 60, 70 yards, so it's going to finish where my drive would finish anyway. I'm going to hit more favours with the 4 iron than the driver. And he just plotted his way around there and in the end took the title. And that's what Padraig's talking about, that there was a lot of his golf, I wouldn't say defensive, that week it was, simply because of the way the golf course was, but he would just push himself into contention at 2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, and then he would either switch on the afterburners, or he would anticipate others making mistakes because he was at the top of the leaderboard.
Yes.
And he would cruise on that way. Yeah? A brilliant golfing brain. I mean, yes, a wonderful golfer. Great putter, great chipper, great iron player, whatever. But a brilliant, brilliant golfing brain.
And Ewan, would you have had any extra access to Woods, either his practice or around tournaments, through Butch?
I did do. Before Tiger and I fell out, which was a bit unfortunate, but I used to get up at 5 o'clock, the same time as Butch, and we'd go up the golf course because Tiger would always play at 6:15, 6:10, and get 9 holes in before the galleries. And he was an immaculate young man, great at telling jokes, always smart, always tidy, and that kind of went with the way he played golf, positional golf, very well aware of what you could and couldn't do in certain holes. And we would have a great time over these 9 holes. There'd be a bit of laughing and joking in there. And of course, there'd be times when he'd be concentrating, chipping around each green, maybe 6 or 7 different places.
Mm.
But I was most fortunate to be able to do that. And I used to keep my distance. I'd be maybe 10 or 15 yards away from Butch and Tiger because they were at work. I was just enjoying myself, basically. And as I say, he was an immaculate young man. His manners were outstanding.
That's nice. That's nice to hear, actually, because I'm sure you've read all the same books we have on Woods, the recent editions, and the Jeff Benedict one recently does not paint him in a nice light. And I'm not even talking about the more headline grabbing behavior. It in just his day to day dealings with people painted him in a terrible light. So it's actually quite nice to hear a different account of being around Woods.
Well, at that point, he was 21, 22, 23. He's had a tremendously difficult life. Only Woods will know how difficult that life is, but he's constantly in the spotlight. He was the Muhammad Ali, wasn't he? He was the most famous sportsman throughout his career. Everyone knew who Tiger Woods was, even if he didn't play golf. And I guess that wore him down a little. And he did get sharper. And then he made a few mistakes, like we all do. But I think everyone should be given a second chance, and he was. And he came back and did some amazing things. But the life, you've got to remember, he turned pro in 96, and here we are in 2021. And at the beginning of this year, he's in the headlines for all the wrong reasons once again. And there's rumours he had arguments before he got in the car. Whether they're true or not, I have no idea. But he went through an awful long period with the eyes of the world on him. And that's difficult. I'm sure that's tremendously difficult. He dealt with it very well for a long time. And I think in the end, that probably got to him a little.
Yes. The fallout, I presume, is the comment when he was spitting and you called him out on TV. Is that the falling out?
Yeah, it was in Dubai and I was in the commentary booth with Harold Clark on the 12th green, final day. It was 10:45 UK time, so pretty well into the final round, a few holes left to go. And he had a bad putt at 12 and he got up and he spat 4 feet from the hole. And I just said something like that, the inspiration he is, not just to golfers, but to sportsmen around the world. There's times when he's arrogant and he's petulant, and what he's just done there is about as low as it gets. It was words to that effect, almost exactly that. And Howard was going to come in and I switched his mic off because I didn't want him to get involved, which I knew was going to be the fallout. And I went through 3 months of hell after that. I believe he got fined by the European Tour. But had I said nothing and I'd come home, my bosses would have been quite right in coming up to me saying, why are we paying you? This guy spurts all over the green. There's three groups behind him trying to win a golf tournament and he's spitting 4 feet from the hole and you said nothing. So I hate these moments. It's a bit like Tyrrell Hatton. At the beginning of his career, I saw Tyrrell before anyone knew who Tyrrell was and I thought, this guy is special. He's a really good golfer. And one day up in Aberdeen at the Scottish Open, he had a chance to win that, which would have got him in the top 60 of the race to Dubai. It would have got him an open place. and he's throwing clubs about and moaning and shouting. And I saw a bit of myself in that, because I was a bit like that as a kid. I was a bit fiery, and I knew it didn't work. And here he was with all these things on the line, and he's worried about a putt lipping out. Well, only he's worried about it, nobody else. And I just said something like, I don't know what you're thinking at home, but this is becoming quite tiresome.
Mm.
And I went through hell for a month or two after that as well. Not as bad as the Woods one, but all I'm doing is I'm saying, this guy needs to stop this, because he's a really good golfer. And if he continues doing this, he's going to throw all the talent,
yes,
and the gifts that he has out the window. That's really what I was trying to say.
Yeah. And Ewan, explain to us, what does going through hell mean? What do you mean by that? And why did you go through hell for 3 months after the Woods fallout?
Well, people can get your email address. They can get all your other stuff. I don't think I might have been on social media. Then I only do Twitter. I don't do anything else. But there was some terrible stuff. When you come to the States, we'll have you and all this stuff. And Sky were very good. They understood what was going on as well. And it blew over. Like all these things, they blew over. But the thing was, Woods was the king. He was the very top man. And whereas I was very happy to watch all of his golf, I wasn't happy about that one, because I think he was wrong. And quite simply, if he hadn't done it, it wouldn't have been said.
And presumably, one way or another, maybe directly, who knows, it was made clear to you that there was a cool wind blowing from the Woods camp in your direction.
Yeah, there was. His manager didn't do anything to me, although I know who he is. But what helped more than anything was Tiger walking past on the range and his eyes straight ahead and not so much as a good morning, because much as I admired him as a player in his younger years, I admired him very much as a person.
Right. And that's after a lot of early mornings where I'm sure there was a hello you and how you and a bit of time spent together.
Yeah, and Tiger was a great joke teller, which he obviously got off Butch, because Butch is probably the best joke teller out there.
Mm.
And Woods was very good at telling them, and he enjoyed telling them. And it was good fun. And there wouldn't be filthy jokes. There'd be jokes about all sorts of things,
yeah, but
normally very funny. And I remember walking on that range in the steely glare and nothing. I felt, disappointed, maybe.
Yeah.
But maybe a little hurt as well.
Yeah. Of course, you would feel hurt. And if he was to walk by you on the range last year, would there be a nod, or is it still fairly steely eyes ahead?
I would think the latter. I would think with steely eyes ahead. I did it because I had to do it. And I've had to do it on two or three occasions where players haven't maybe behaved properly, where they've snapped a club over their knee. And you have to remember that the parents with young children are watching it. And if you say nothing, you know what kids are like. They think, well, I could do that.
Yeah.
But if you state that this is not the way forward, and this is something that will hold you back if you want to be a decent golfer, a golf professional, or a professional golfer, that this is going to hold you back. So you need not do it. And I did get a letter from a dad whose son was 11. And when that wood spit went on the screen, and just saying thank you, because everyone adores Woods. All these kids adore Woods. He's their idol. They all want to be Tiger Woods. But pointing out that that wasn't the way forward has helped me enormously with my son.
I'm sorry to hear that, Ewan, because, I mean, look, this is me saying this. I'm not putting words in your mouth. But frankly, I would think to myself, Tiger Woods, of anyone who's made some apologies and made some mistakes in his life, understands that forgiveness is an important thing. We're all human. We all make mistakes. In this case, you were doing your job. It wasn't personal. I would have thought 7-8 years on, we can let that one go. But that just shows, if you're cut from the Woods camp, you are cut. That's game over.
Well, and also, I don't see so much of him.
Of course.
Either. Obviously, over the last 18 months, I haven't seen him.
Yeah.
And probably 3 or 4 years before that, Butch was no longer coaching him, so that link wasn't there.
Fair enough.
But it hurt a little. I have a picture of Tiger that was drawn by an artist. He was a professional golfer in the ladies' tour, Rebecca Hudson. And she paints, she's a brilliant artist, and she crayoned a portrait of Tiger. And I took it over to Tiger and he signed it. And it sits and it's got pride and place in the house. And it's Tiger in 2000. You know, the year he just spread eagled everybody, including the sport. but it sits there and I admire it because I look back at the times that I had with them and they were very enjoyable times. Mm,
I can imagine. One last thought for you. A few people were in touch asking me to ask you because, again, and you wear your knowledge very lightly, by the way, in commentary. I love, as a matter, just as an aside, when there's a bad swing and you come in before the expert beside you and you diagnose what went wrong in the swing in a line. I think that's great. I love that. And so, you know, you wear your knowledge lightly, but you'll see what went wrong. And I think that's super as well. But therefore, I'm curious for your thoughts on Rory, because there'd be a growing contingent now, I notice, of our listeners who would be of the opinion that, like, this guy's great. He owes golf nothing. He owes nobody anything. It's a legendary career already. But their honest sense would be the odds now on him not winning a major again have grown considerably. And that would have been unthinkable 18 months, 2 years ago, given his age. Whereas now people are saying sometimes you lose it. It's just harder and harder to get it back. What's your read on where Rory is?
Well, first of all, the analysis of the swing, if you fit enough bad shots, you actually know the feelings I have and the motion. So that's where that comes from.
Okay.
Rory, I think, a little bit like Tiger in the sense that we put so much focus on Rory. Our expectations of Rory are sky high when you think it's, 7 years since he won a major. He is not in the same class as a wedge player as his peers. And that's where I stand with McIlroy. Driving, long irons, mid irons, he's a good chipper. He's a decent bunker player. He's just not good enough from 60 yards to 140. And if you look at Morikawa, who has won 2 majors out of the last 7, if you look at Dustin Johnson, having won the Masters in November, 2nd major for him, they work on their scoring shots. Mm. When you think how far the ball goes now, how many second shots does Rory have between 60 and 150 yards, let's say? He has a lot. He has a high percentage. You go back to 2011, which is where I think the problem started. I watched his drive off the first tee. It was still rising when it got over the bunker that people were hitting the tee shots into. He was maybe 115 from the pin. Long, loopy hook, 3 putts. Everyone looks at the tee shot at 10. They look at the collapse on the back nine, the tee shot at 13, the missed putt at 12. It started at the first. If McIlroy had been sharper with his wedge, he would have got off to at least a par start. Then he's got a par 5 that he can reach with driving a 6-iron. Because he takes the 5 at the first, he doesn't get the 4 at the second.
You're talking Augusta here, presumably, you and I.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah. As far back as that. Everyone's talking about it now. McIlroy's wedges are just not good enough with the people he's playing alongside. And as I say, he's got many of them because of his gifts off the tee of long and relatively straight driving, given the length he hits it.
Yeah.
His scoring shots should be the wedges, and they're not. He puts too often from 35, 40 feet after a wedge, whereas you get someone like Morikawa, he's exactly the right distance. So he's not going to be that far offline. So he's not having the 35-footers. He's having the 10 and 12-footers.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, I think, with McIlroy today. If you look at his follow-through with a wedge, it's the same as the drive. So the club's getting slung, which means with loft, it's going to turn. You ever rarely see McIlroy try and cut a wedge into a right-hand pin. And I think if he sharpens up in that department, which I don't think really should take too long, that should be something that he's more than capable of achieving in a short space of time. And he goes out with the same wedge game as the others, I think you'll find McIlroy on his day will beat them. That's how good I think he is.
Yeah, because on the coverage at Royal St. George's, again, I think it might have been as short in as 115, and pin was on the right, and there was a little left to right breeze, and everyone was just fading it in on the breeze and letting it trickle down to the pin, and Rory started right and missed right and had to come in off the green, or had to chip onto the green from the right and short-sighted himself. And Laura Davies, in a very genuine way, and on the commentary, just half said aloud, "This is so strange. He's such a good player. This is just so strange." And that was my thought, because I'm far from a professional golfer, and yet I think most of us would feel more comfortable with a shorter club in our hands than a driver. And he can do, in my book, the harder thing. And yet the wedges, I don't know, like, we've seen him try the more sawn-off finish at times. He's clearly working on it. He snapped a club last year. I mean, I think that was an example of just how frustrated he must be. That suggested to me he is practicing with the wedges and was so frustrated he cracked a club because he thought, well, this practice isn't paying off.
I know the shot you're talking about. It's second to the second.
Yeah.
Which was the easiest shot in the world. Middle of the green, little bit of cut spin, the wind will do the rest for you. And it didn't happen once, it happened twice with him. And later on in the round. The other thing with Rory, I find, is that if you look at his head position at impact, his chin almost sits on his right shoulder. Now, that would be Rory being a small kid trying to hit the ball a long way, and that would be built into his game very early on. With that head position and loft, it's very difficult to start the ball left, which is why Rory, when he draws the ball, is as good as anyone. It's natural. If he sends it down the right centre of the fairway, it's got a draw of no more than 2 or 3 yards. And I often think he should maybe just continue to pitch like that rather than try and have a different action for that shot, because the rest is always going to be with him. It's been there from a very young age. And as I say, it probably comes from him trying to hit the ball a bit further as a 7, 8, 9 year old. But if you look, his chin sits on his right side and on his right shoulder, and it's very difficult then to start the ball left. So all of those who are saying he needs to learn to fade the ball in there, that's going to be extremely difficult for McIlroy, because he's a natural golfer with a natural shape. I think what he should be trying to do is work on the wedges with the shape he has, and he's good enough to fade one in there now and again, because it's not a power shot. His head's not going to work backwards. That's the way I see McIlroy, but I see the only problem with him is that yardage, 60 to 150. If he can improve that, he'll have 80% more birdie putts that are holeable rather than 80% he seems to have right now where he's trying to get the ball close.
Ewan Murray, it's been such a pleasure. I mean, you're a fountain of knowledge. It was great talking to you. I guess you're into watching your 30th year with Sky next year. So, congratulations on an amazing career. Enjoy the Ryder Cup. We'll all be watching, and we might nag you for an interview again in 18 months and see what's going on in the world of golf. But it really has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Lovely. I'd look forward to that, and thank you for today. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle. Starter kit right here.